Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at edexcellence.net. Now, please join me in welcoming my guest co-host, the only man in education policy who can do a triple toe loop, Andy Samarick.
Hey, Mike, how are you?
I'm well. How about yourself?
Well, I'm thrilled to be back. I was suspended for some reason or another, haven't been here in a while, but it's great.
No, now there's no conspiracy here. It's just that our regular co-host, Rick Hess, has unusually been available.
No, we can tell the truth, pull the curtains back. I was using performance-enhancing drugs, and you guys decided you had to cut me off because I was doing so well at the podcast for so long.
That is true.
You slapped my wrist.
So, back to this ice skating thing. I don't know, Andy. I just think that you do look like a male figure skater to me.
Well, I have no idea what to say about that other than I tried to ice skate once, and so I roller skated a lot when I was young. Mm-hmm. We had this place called Super Skate near where I lived. So back in the 80s, I have these vivid memories of roller skating to Abracadabra.
Mm-hmm.
But so for some reason, that's right. Laura, can you find that song? Anyway, I tried to ice skate once, and it was god awful. It was just, I mean, my ankles couldn't do it.
Wow. Wow. Now, Andy, there's something that I thought that you and our listeners would enjoy listening to. Laura, go ahead and roll the tape. Is that adorable or what? Can you hear what's going on there?
I could.
Who let the dogs out?
So Mike has a 2-year-old son who is a budding rap star.
Was that rap? I don't know if you would consider that rap, but yeah. Anyways, I thought that was adorable, and I haven't, you know, really brought my son into the podcast very often, but I, you know, as a proud father, I just thought that you would all enjoy listening to my 2-year-old brilliant son singing "Who Let the Dogs Out."
It's only the American way, you know. I gotta get him started early.
Yeah, exactly. American Idol, here we come.
That's right.
How old does he have to be to qualify on that?
16.
All right. So we have a lot to cover today, although, again, full disclosure, folks, I should say it up front, no research minute. Go ahead and click off. I know.
It's the only reason I listen.
I know, Andy, it's true. But Amber is still in Thailand, as far as we know. What?
It's going to be a great show.
Oh, Stafford's got her feelings hurt. Yes, of course everybody listens for Rate That Reform. But we do get a lot of accolades for the research minute. But you know what? I think Andy and I might come up with some shtick for a minute later in the show.
No doubt. We're going to bring it.
Okay. All right. But right now we're going to play a little part in the gadfly. Mickey Muldoon, please get us started.
All right.
Abracadabra. Okay, go ahead. Sorry.
That was a probably intro music. Fordham's newest report, America's Private Public Schools, was released last week, documenting the roughly 2,800 American public schools that serve very few poor students. So, is 2,800 too high a number? And if so, what do you think would be an appropriate number of so-called public-private schools in America?
Well, Mike, you were the one of the two great authors of this report. Is it acceptable to have any of these schools?
So we were careful in this report not to weigh in on those kinds of questions. We weren't saying that these schools are bad or a problem or should go away, because frankly, they're not going to go away. But we wanted to raise awareness of the fact that these schools exist and that there's a lot of hypocrisy out there in the education debate about what it means to be a public school. So keep this in mind. These schools serve about 1.7 million kids. That's more than 10 charter schools. Mm-hmm. Okay, so this is about 4% of the population versus 3% in charter schools. So still small numbers, but bigger than charter school population. These are schools that have basically less than 5% of their kids are low income. This is in a country where right now 43% of the nation's kids are poor enough to qualify for a free or reduced price lunch. These schools do not happen by accident. And so if the teacher unions and other members of the education establishment want to make this argument that charter schools or vouchers somehow hurt public education, and they say that in public education is public because we serve all comers, except when they don't.
That's right.
And in some metro areas, in New York metro area, okay, New York City and all the suburbs around it, almost 30% of the white public school kids go to these exclusive private public schools. All right, so there are clearly places in this country where these private public schools are more exclusive than your typical private school, which at least gives scholarships to needy kids, and they're certainly more private than the typical inner city Catholic school that's going to take in kids with vouchers.
No, yeah, no doubt at all. I mean, there are plenty of Catholic schools. I mean, we stone's throw from where we are right now that are serving 90% or more low-income kids. And really what I thought of most when I read this report was, I mean, just think of how often we've been told the charter schools cream, or that the private schools are doing nothing but taking the best and brightest and hurting the traditional public school system, when in fact there are communities that are virtually completely off limits to the most disadvantaged kids among us. And I mean, policy-wise, you can think of the NCLB choice mechanism, where there were a lot of kids in urban areas that were supposed to get access to higher performing schools, and their districts told them, no, you just can't, that we have no schools like that. And yet probably 5 miles, 7, 10 miles away, there are these schools that are lily white and very affluent, and yet kids don't have access to them. It's heartbreaking.
So, and you know, the private schools have decided, by and large, that they see value in providing scholarships to needy kids to be able to attend them. I think these public schools could do basically the same thing, offer scholarships for out-of-boundary kids, create slots to make that happen. I wonder if then that conversation will happen in these schools. Okay, topic number two.
Okay. In a speech at the National Governors Association yesterday, President Obama indicated that states will be required to adopt, quote, college and career-ready academic standards to receive federal money under the Elementary and Secondary Education Act. Is this the ultimate victory for the standards movement?
Well, there are a couple things that need to be said about this. So the first thing is we should recognize that this is kind of 2.0 of Race to the Top. So Race to the Top tried to get states to embrace this through an incentive mechanism. But now what the department is saying, the administration is saying, is it's not going to be such an incentive anymore. If you want to get Title I money, you got to go in this direction of what we're calling college and career-ready standards. But the big question then becomes, what exactly are college and career-ready standards? So we know that there's this big, big, big movement to get states to do common standards. Are those two things synonymous? So are the common standards going to be college and career-ready? There are some states like California and Texas who are saying, our standards are going to be better than those. And so what happens if, so on the one hand, what if the common ones aren't good enough? Or what happens in another case where a state says, yes, we're going to certify that our standards are good enough, and it appears that the Department of Education is going to let states certify which are good enough. So it just raises all these kind of questions. What is good enough? Who gets to decide what's good enough? This sounds good when it's in an article. When it's written in policy, all bets are off.
See, this is really mind-boggling to me, and I'm nervous about it. I mean, I'm sure the administration is saying, look, all we're saying is you have to have college and career-ready standards. We're trying to raise the bar. But everybody is assuming what they really mean is you have to adopt these common national standards. And those of us that support national standards and testing all along, we've said, look, politically, the last thing you want to do is to require states to adopt national standards. It's got to be voluntary. It's got to be bottom-up. It's got to be state-led. That effort has been ongoing, and you know, there's some ups and downs, and we're not sure how the standards are going to come out. But suddenly, to have the president say, we're going to force you to have these college-ready standards and have everybody think that what they really mean is you have to do national standards, whew, all of a sudden, that is just pleading for a backlash, and that makes me nervous, because this is a worthwhile objective, but it's going to give the Tea Party types a lot to take a whack at.
Well, the problem is, so the department is giving themselves a way out, it appears, by saying, no, we're not telling states they have to do common standards. We're just making them certify that they have college and career-ready standards. But then the question becomes, well, NCLB said that they had to have really good standards, and if states are in charge of setting their own standards, of course they're going to do what they want, and of course they're going to say our standards are wonderful. I mean, you had a run-in with Wisconsin on more than one occasion where they and other states think their standards are absolutely wonderful when the data is saying otherwise. So I just don't know how this is actually going to get implemented, which direction they're going to go in. Are they really going to force states to do something? And if not, why do they think states are going to certify that their bad standards are good, or just willingly make them better?
Okay, topic number three.
Also at the NGA conference over the weekend, Minnesota Governor Tim Pawlenty was spotted cornering Arnie Duncan, presumably to put in a good word for his state's Race to the Top application, just 2 days after making his comment about, quote, breaking the window of big government at the CPAC conference. Is there any inconsistency in this course of action?
What's the operative word in that question? Anyone do a close reading? presumably. We have no idea what these two guys were talking about. Pauletti could have cornered him to say, hey, do you want to play basketball sometime? Or, hey, you ought to come up here and see some things that we're doing that you guys haven't put in your Race to the Top application.
Oh, Andy, you're not having any fun with this at all. Come on.
Yeah, but let's presume that this was the case. I mean, why else would he be cornering Andy Duncan?
But this is what I like, is that, you know, the administration's been very clear. This is all about what the reviewers say. It's all going to come down to the points. And yet, there's plenty of governors out there that seem to think that a little bit of lobbying is going to go a long way. From Ohio, we have similar stories about Governor Strickland doing what he can to communicate with the White House and Arne Duncan about how important it is for Ohio to bring home the bacon. I think the administration has set itself up in some difficult places by not being more transparent with the process that's going on with the reviewers, by not naming the reviewers, by not just disclosing everything about how this is going to go down. Because at the end of the day, and you know this from being inside the department too, Andy, there's going to be some judgment calls. There's going to be, you know, it doesn't just come down to points. I'll give you an example. They've got something like four or five different panels reviewing different applications from different states. Well, what if one of the panels is a really hard grader? And so the states in their lot don't do very well. What if another panel has two really good applications? I mean, there's all this nuance that comes in to decide who's going to get the money. I don't know. Maybe at the end of the day, Arne Duncan will get to make some decisions, and this kind of lobbying will pay off.
In my view, I really believe that their decision not to release the names of the reviewers in advance may turn out to be the biggest unforced error that this administration in education has made. They are setting themselves up, no doubt, for all kinds of questions and all kinds of complaints later. All they had to do was release it, and all of it would have gone away. I mean, my honest-to-God prediction on this is that when the awards get made, if not a scandal, there are going to be a whole lot of questions about who these reviewers are. They were biased. Oh, we didn't know that preponderance of them were from this place or were educated here. Huge unforced error.
So, well, you know, I do hope, by the way, Mickey, that we're supposedly going to hear about who the finalists are next week. I think Andy broke that on the Flypaper blog. But the question is, then these finalists come in. They're going to fly in. They're going to do some presentations to the Department of Ed. What I want to know is, you know, are those going to be webcast? Are we going to get to see those presentations? And B, will they include singing? I mean, do you think they're going to really put their all into it and you know, jazz it up a little bit?
In Maryland, they have this awful process where they call it the Begathon, where all the districts, like counties, have to go before the governor, the Board of Public Works, and beg for money every year for all these different projects. And it's actually sad. It's almost demeaning to see county executives and superintendents go before this Board of Public Works and say, please give us money. This is what it's going to kind of... I'm worried that this is what it's going to be like, governor, state superintendents going before this peer review panel at the Department of Education. And so you were joking about singing and dancing. We should expect there to be some drama here. Mm-hmm. It's not just going to be PowerPoint presentations. Expect them to bring in kids. Expect them to show their broken down schools that they really need money for. Expect them to do all types of very dramatic things.
I think they bring celebrities with them, potentially, to make their pitch.
I wouldn't be surprised if a state does something like that.
Mm-hmm. There you go. Well, I do hope they televise it. It could make for some good watching, but it would also be helpful to have these politicians go on the record making promises to the administration that we could all hold them to.
Agreed.
All right. That is more than enough time on Pardon the Gadfly. We went over. We were not as tight because we have all this free time because of Amber's absence. But you know what? Sometimes free time's not a good thing, is it?
What's up, Stafford?
Not too much.
No talking to her before we hear her theme song.
You're not dancing. What's wrong? Dance. There you go.
I've heard this how many times now?
Yeah, we need to get you a new song.
I know. Well, I
Abracadabra?
Mean,
ooh, I like that. That is a good option.
What about Nico? I was just going to say Nico should be my intro song. Today we are talking about WebcamGate. By now, I'm sure our listeners have heard about the school in Lower Merion, Pennsylvania, which remotely activated webcams on school laptops after hours. And the principal made a comment to a student about some, quote, inappropriate behavior going on during the student's free time. Parents filed a suit over a breach of privacy. School claims they were merely using the remote webcam activation feature to locate laptops that were missing or had been removed from school properties, and that the cams could only take photos and not require sound. Now, the FBI is investigating this as an inappropriate case of surveillance while students have put duct tape over their webcams in protest. Lower Merion districts claim that this is a teachable moment, They were ahead of the technology curve by giving high school students laptops, and obviously some kinks in the system had to be worked out. I'm going to go ahead and call BS on the Lower Merion School District for that explanation. Let's break it down. The problem trying to be solved here, presumably, is missing laptops. And district officials claim that in the 72 times in the past 14 months that the webcams have been activated by two, quote, IT professionals on district staff, that they were merely hunting for laptops that were taken off campus or had gone, quote, missing. But the solution that the district actually came up with was so inefficient and costly that I'm absolutely stumped. The illegality, the naivete, we can put that all on the side. Why didn't they, for example, take a disciplinary tack, like, say, telling students to turn on their missing laptop or turn in their missing laptops to the principal's office or be suspended, or a financial tack, like, say, requiring a deposit as collateral for the computers, or, I don't know, locking up the laptops at the end of the day? Instead, they decide to use visual aids, and presumably to do it after hours. How did they make sense of the images the computers took? Were these two IT professionals paid overtime for working after hours? And how did they know that the computers were even on, or that the laptops were even in a position to capture any image at all, except one of the keyboard?
You're fired up, aren't you?
Well, because I read the story, and I was like, all the coverage has been about how this is illegal, how we're breaking all these laws, blah, 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 blah. But the solution for the problem was just so dumb. It's just so dumb. There's this program. It's called Computer LoJack. You just load it onto the computer. It's like GPS. You always know the computer is your computer gets stolen.
I'm totally confused. I mean, so how is turning on the camera supposed to help them find the...
Apparently, they would be able to see where the laptop was and, I don't know, read minds, you know, look into their crystal ball and figure out where the laptop was. That is the explanation that's coming out of the district right now.
Yeah, that doesn't sound so likely. All right, so
guess what grade I gave
it. I suspect there's going to be a pink slip coming.
An F. Maybe an F minus. I don't bust that out very often, but this one's pretty bad.
Yeah.
I mean, what are you paying them overtime to do this illegal?
No, all right. You assume that this has got to be bogus, the whole thing about why they were turning on the cameras, right? That they were going to help find the, I mean, I think the whole premise sounds iffy, right? So isn't the assumption that maybe some of these employees were really trying to spy on high school kids?
To what end?
Because they're perverts. Who knows? Well, I mean, that seems the most likely explanation.
I mean, they had two people on the district staff whose job were to track down these laptops. And, I mean, it's not even clear if they were doing it during school, because obviously they were looking for laptops that had gone missing. Mm. They must have been doing it at night. So were they working? I mean, what was the district paying them? Extra money to, you know, work at 8 o'clock at night to find? I mean, how would they, if the laptop is not open, then the webcam's not in a position to even take a picture? I mean, it's the stupidest thing I've ever heard. Like, what did they...
This is why we should go back to paper and pencil, Andy.
No doubt at all about that. I mean, part of me feels bad for these guys. I mean, I could imagine maybe they made a little mistake, but some guy right now is probably thinking, it's my job to find these computers. I tried to do this little thing where I would use the cameras, and now it's a national story, and the very important Education Gadfly podcast is making fun of me.
Yeah. Or that guy is a big pervert. That's the other strong possibility here.
So for those keeping score at home, I give people the benefit of the doubt.
Yes, you do. You always do. You're too nice. Mike
assumes not only the worst, but the nastiest as well. Oh my.
Wow.
I mean, maybe the FBI will find out that they're all perverts, and then they'll uncover some kiddie porn ring and all these people will go to prison.
Mm-hmm. All we know is people are trying to find a computer.
Wait, you just can't take this another couple steps? No, Andy.
Andy, there's a missing logic here, okay? Trying to find a computer, going to remotely activate the webcam. I don't see how those two things can be remotely connected to one another.
And you know what the worst part is?
Maybe it's Jason Bourne. Maybe these guys know what they're doing.
The Computer LoJack program is so cheap. It's so cheap. I mean,
you should be an IT specialist. Why don't you go work for a district and solve these problems?
All right.
I don't know. Laura and I will launch our own company, right, Laura? Yes. Education technology.
All right. Well, thank you, Stafford, for always bringing us these kinds of exploits.
I like to see you fired up about stuff like this. It does my heart good.
She is almost Cooner-esque. For some of our longtime listeners, you know what I'm talking about.
That's great.
All right. That is all the time that we have this week. Until next week.
I'm Abracadabra.
And I'm Mike Petrilli. who let the dogs out here on the Education Gadfly Show at edexcellence.net, signing off.